Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about trusts and just some basic information about how you maintain a trust and a little bit about what it is. We circle back to this topic periodically, Jill, probably what, a couple times a year maybe?
Right.
I just find that we do a disservice if we fail to fill people in on what I think maybe their lawyers might have failed to do, or in fairness, their lawyers might have told them, and it's easy to have missed the message or have forgotten the message.
Right, and you want to clarify, what exactly is a trust and how does it work?
Yeah. So we won't bore you with this. This is the sort of thing that I resist this analogy, but I'll charge forward. You know, you need to go to the dentist periodically. It's not a happy thing. It's not something you necessarily look forward to.
Everyone agrees
it's essential, and a lot of pain results if you decide that you're never going to go to a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going to an estate planning lawyer maybe once a year, but certainly occasionally as your life changes, your circumstances change, your kids.
Especially then.
Yeah, especially then. I mean, your kids go through a period when they're dependent on you, so you want a plan that does a certain thing, and then later on they're independent, so you may want to change that plan. Sometimes you can have a plan worded so generally that it can pick up a series of changes. I'm not real opposed to those more general estate planning provisions, but you can also be very precise. You can have a custom fit in terms of the circumstances that characterize your life at that period. And that period, incidentally, is not changing every year for the most part.
Right.
It may change every maybe couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, if you get divorced, heaven forbid, if your one spouse passes away, that's probably time for that surviving spouse to think about some estate planning adjustments.
Yes.
There's lots of stuff that happens. We have kids, they're dependent. We have kids, they're no longer dependent. We have kids, we decide that they're not to be trusted with assets that perhaps
that's the big one, I think.
We might have started out giving them the benefit of the doubt. Later we decided maybe that wasn't a good decision. So with my kids, the jury's still out. They're they're in college still. But look, we all have to try to – I suggest we watch out for our kids. Some people – I have clients who are of the opinion that, look, you know, I'm going to leave them the money. It's going to end up with them in equal shares. They'll either handle it well or they won't. But I've done my job. I handed it to them. Now it'll be their responsibility. And I wash my hands of it. So I'm respectful of that perspective. And there's a certain logic and simplicity to it. But if you know that you have this one son, for example, what did I say son? You have this one son who might have lots of problems. I mean, these are well-documented problems.
Right.
These aren't hypothetical.
That would blow that money within a year.
Yeah. So it's not realistic to expect anything but that. But, you know, some people feel like, here's the phrase I hear a lot, I don't want to control from the grave.
Right. I've heard that.
I don't consider it controlling from the grave. I consider it good parenting just like you've done up to that point in your life. I mean,
still looking out for them.
It's looking out for them, knowing who and what they are and planning in a way that you can provide them the most protection. That's all that is. So these are the things that need to be visited occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
So as we've talked in the past, I think everyone who watches this show knows that I'm a big advocate of trust. For most people, that means a revocable trust. Revocable means it's something you can change anytime you want. You can even dump it entirely if you want. You're not making any decisions that you can't reverse easily. In contrast to an irrevocable trusts are marvelous tools for certain circumstances. They're especially marvelous when you want asset protection. If they're carefully drafted, they can allow you to qualify for Medicaid. They can protect your assets from creditors in certain scenarios, not all creditors. Some creditors have super priority, and these would be among them child support, maintenance, taxes.
Okay.
There are a few that fall in those special categories. But for the most part, as to other creditors, they're subject to the terms of this irrevocable trust. So that's attractive to some people, but with those benefits come some loss of control. You have to be willing to place your assets in an entity, or at least under the control of a trust, in which there'll be rules in place. And those rules are not something you can decide you're going to change tomorrow. Otherwise, that wouldn't be fair play. I always tell people who are considering an irrevocable trust that they should be suspicious of anybody who presents to them this option in a way where there's no sacrifice on their part, because it should violate our sense of fair play. If we're going to say, well, I'm going to be able to say to a creditor, look, yes, I do have this $10 million, but it's not available to you, and I realize I owe you $1 million, but I'm sorry, I apologize for that, but you can't have my $10 million. For the law to tolerate a situation like that, the law is going to expect that there be some reciprocal concessions on the part of that debtor. And reciprocal concessions just means that person has committed in a way, has lost some of the control of that money that he might otherwise have. And it may mean that he's placed it in the hands of a trustee that he appoints, and he can remove and appoint. So it's not as if he loses all influence over that money, but there has to be, without going into the details here, I'll avoid getting into the woods. Suffice it to say that there has to be some constraints, some meaningful limitations on that person's access and use of that money in order for him to have those benefits.
So if you do this type of trust and this individual, they have limited access to that money or no access during the time while they're alive?
There are conditions. For example, sometimes the trust will be worded that the beneficiary, or in this case, yeah, we'll call this them the beneficiary. That's the person who is to have the benefits. So they're also – they transfer the money into the trust. That makes them the trustor or the settlor, sometimes called. And they're also the beneficiary. But they wouldn't be the trustee. The trustee is a person who runs the trust. So this person would have transferred the money in under conditions such as, I can have all the income that comes from this money, but I can never touch the principal. That's an example of a common rule in an irrevocable trust. So it's real. It says that this person can no longer reach in and grab the principal. They can have income. Income, what are examples of income? Interest, income.
Okay.
Dividends. Yeah, any proceeds you get from investments like that, generally passive investments, then those are ways in which the person can continue to have that. There may be circumstances where principal could be often given away to third parties. It's not unusual for that person, the beneficiary, to be able to perhaps transfer money to third parties, such as their loved ones and others in the world. In other words, you can give your money away, you just can't use it yourself. That's a meaningful limitation. It doesn't disturb us as much that this person will be able to protect their assets from a creditor because they have given up meaningful control.
It sounds really complicated.
It's a little complicated. It's a little expensive too. Expect that if you're doing an irrevocable trust, and I want people to understand, I'm talking irrevocable trust, not revocable. If we're talking about an irrevocable trust, then yes, they are more complicated. Mm-hmm. Not all estate planning lawyers do them. And you should expect to pay more. It's not unusual to pay, I don't know, $4,000 to $6,000. But
wow,
yeah. But hang on. If you're talking about qualifying for Medicaid as an example, and the Medicaid payment might be $6,000 a month, think about your rate of return on that investment.
Oh, sure, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you might qualify by virtue of proper planning, and not everybody's asset circumstances fit this. But many would if they chose. Many people, for example, who consider themselves middle class, mm-hmm. and they say, gee, I've got $750,000. There's no way I would ever qualify for Medicaid. But it might be that they very well could qualify for Medicaid. It's not uncommon for somebody with that many assets to be able to. But they have to be willing to transfer some of those assets to an irrevocable trust, usually. That's one of the most – that's a go-to tool to obtain that purpose.
Now, could this protect that person's home? Because I understand in some circumstances Medicaid, once the person goes into a nursing home or after they die – if they were a Medicaid recipient, they can lose their home. The state can take that house.
Eventually, yeah. It's called asset recovery. And the attorneys general of every state now is required by CMS, which runs Medicaid. States attorneys general are required to go out and run down assets of recipients. So many people, when they hear that their home is exempt, that's a technical term as it's used. Exempt doesn't mean what most people think it means. It does mean that you can continue living in your house, or a loved one like your spouse or a dependent child can continue living in your home while you may be in a long-term care facility.
Sure.
And that home could have hundreds of thousands of dollars of equity in it, and you're still qualifying for Medicaid. That's true, but there's a big red flag there. And the red flag is that when you pass away or when it's deemed that you can never return home, if there's not one of those dependents in the house, then you lose it even while you're alive. Let's say that you go into a nursing home,
right.
spouse dies. Your spouse dies. And at that point, you're not in the house with no chance of returning home. And that's a little bit of a – it's a very squishy definition. Can you return home? But if it's determined that there's no reasonable chance you'll ever return home, then, yeah, that can be sold during your lifetime. But even the best-case scenario, it's sold when you're gone. So it's a short-term victory to say, yeah, my house is exempt. It's not really exempt in a meaningful way.
But what does that same apply to someone that was just on Medicaid but they were never in a nursing home and then they pass away? Can Medicaid still come in?
Yeah, there's still asset recovery.
But how often does that really happen? I heard that doesn't happen too often.
Well, for long-term care, whether it's home or in a facility, it is. Used to it wasn't. Just states were very permissive. They weren't very conscientious about following up. It wasn't their money at the time, so to speak. But it's become a big deal now. The federal government has made clear that if you're going to get these matching funds, et cetera, you're going to go after this money. So now it is. It's funny. There's only this Medicaid issue when you have people that are qualifying for Medicaid for long-term care. I mean, your average Medicaid recipient, if you put aside long-term care, I mean, they're not people who have assets. They're broke people, which is what they're supposed to be if they're qualifying for Medicaid. They're supposed to be broke. But the way long-term care works, you can use your assets in such a way to where you can get, you know, the cost of a nursing home, it might be $10,000 a month, you can get your expenses paid through Medicaid indefinitely.
Right.
So
right.
It's very attractive for people who have assets that they've been a lifetime accumulating. It's the only thing they have to leave their children, mm-hmm. their family, and they feel a duty to just like tax planning. It's just being a conscientious financial manager to be sure that you take advantage of the tax deductions that are available to you. Why would anyone not do that? And it's really the same analysis. If you can qualify for Medicaid and still preserve assets, a legacy for your family, why wouldn't you do that?
Right.
So that's the reasoning. But the nice thing then, in answer to your question about a house, is that a better way than the sort of short-term relief that you would normally have is to transfer that house into an irrevocable trust. And you're right, that's a common purpose of an irrevocable trust for people who are planning for long-term care, is that they want to have the house truly liberated or free of any sort of claim to it by asset recovery. Now, we've been talking about the irrevocable trust, and I really wanted, though, to give a little bit of attention to its more common sibling, far more common sibling, which is the revocable trust. While I don't like to make general statements, this is one that I feel pretty comfortable making, and that's that most anybody should have, in my opinion, a revocable trust.
And why is that?
It's because it doesn't cost that much more than a will, and it does so much more. Now, granted, you can be broke, and I would say, yes, I get it. There's nothing to preserve, so why bother? But for most people listening to this show, they own something in this world, something of value. And in those cases, unless it's less than $40,000, which is that's the threshold for small estate administration, $40,000 at that $40,000 and below, and that's net value. So you could have a house that has a market value of $150,000,
right,
but you have debt of $120,000. So that's a net estate of less than $40,000. In that case, it's very fast and swift. You're not dealing with probate for months on end, ads that have to run for 6 months in legal periodicals to notify any creditors that are out there in the world, you know, this very public access to whatever was there in terms of your estate. If there's not much there and you qualify for small estate administration where it's in and out fast, I get it. Maybe you don't want to bother with that. But that's not most of the people listening to this show. I know that. It's more likely that you have assets that you can entirely avoid the probate process, and you can do it in a more orderly fashion than simply changing titles to payable on death or transfer on death or a beneficiary deed, which is a change of title on
sure,
a deed.
Sure, like for a home.
Yeah, for a home or any piece of real estate. There are piecemeal approaches to estate planning, but I'm reluctant to call it planning because it's really just a item by item decision. How can I get this around probate? So if you're going to have a plan and you have loved ones and you want to design it in a way that's going to address their needs and their circumstances, mm-hmm, and minimize costs of transfer, then I think that a lot's to be said for having a revocable trust. The revocable trust, it's simple to operate. One reason I'd like to talk about this once or twice a year is that I want to remind people that if you've gone to a lawyer and you've spent maybe $1,000, depending on your state, you may have spent $2,000 or $3,000 on your revocable trust. But I would expect if you spend more that you have a vehicle that's more customized for your particular situation. But in any case, whatever you spent, think of it. The best analogy I can use is one like a corporation. People understand, I think, if I were to ask many of you listening to me now, if you form a corporation and you have a piece of real estate and that real estate is in your name, I think you would know, just in your life experiences, you would know that I need to change the title of that real estate and put it in the corporation. Otherwise, the corporation is not going to give me any protection.
Okay.
So most people understand a corporation is this sort of artificial thing that you change the title to stuff and put it in the corporation, or things are engages in business, and so things are actually bought and sold by the corporation. That too. So really, if you want to apply that same analogy to a trust, then you'll understand that if you've gone and gotten this beautiful trust for which you've paid a significant amount of money, and then you go home and put it in a drawer thinking it's like a will,
mm-hmm,
then you've wasted your money because the trust will only speak to what you put in it. And if you don't put anything in it, then it doesn't have the assets.
And then
those assets still go through probate.
Right.
So the whole idea of a trust is that by putting stuff in it, it's like – I'll use the corporation analogy. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think it makes the point. People understand that if a corporation owns assets, and let's say that you own the stock of the corporation and you die, well, the assets in the corporation go on. Now, your stock, you may figure out where that goes, but the point is the asset lives on in the corporation. The corporation isn't affected by the deaths of stockholders,
okay,
and whatnot. It continues on. And so a trust is like that. You can have generations of beneficiaries. Like if you decide to create a revocable trust, your goal should be two-pronged. On the one hand, you want to benefit during your lifetime. You're wanting to know, boy, I have this beautiful setup now so that the moment that I may have a stroke or something happens to me to where I become incompetent, the moment that happens, immediately I've identified a person who now is to succeed me as trustee managing these assets.
Right.
But the beneficiary stays the same, which is you.
So typically, with a trust, it doesn't go through probate, but a will does. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's the – that's what trusts are most known for, though they accomplish a lot more. But yeah, most people who go to a lawyer and get a revocable trust, they pay that extra several hundred dollars or maybe a little more, but they pay that often because they're mainly concerned about nothing going through probate. And to contrast these two pictures, probate means probably at least a year that your stuff's tied up.
Wow, a year?
Yeah, yeah. Realistically, because you have to run ads for 6 months. So realistically, you're probably looking at a year.
For a will.
Yeah, and if there's contests, forget it. It's going to be significantly longer typically. But here, it doesn't stop there. I mean, you can look at the statute and see how much money you're paying to lawyers. Your personal representative is allowed a certain scheduled amount of money that you can look up in the statute. You know, like personal representative compensation Missouri, and you'll find a schedule of percentages that they get based on the size of the estate. It's very profitable to be a personal representative. And funny, that same amount of money will go to a lawyer. So it's like a duplicate expense. And that will be paid on every estate unless those people decide I don't want it. You can see, mm-hmm. imagine how often that happens. And furthermore, they can have more. What the language says for lawyers, and this is very interesting. You should read this statute. Those of you who are listening, probably most of you, there'll be a few of you who may have the sort of curiosity to do this. When you read the statute the way it's written, one thing is clear. Lawyers wrote that statute. Because what it says is not that this percentage, which can result in hundreds of thousands of dollars on a larger estate. I would go through the calculations, but the percentages change at each stage. So you have a 5% for a certain level of assets, and then for
right.
the assets beyond that, it goes the next striation or the next layer of assets would be like 4%. Then you have a layer that is at 3%, et cetera, et cetera. So the way that this statute's worded is that they have a claim to that. However, and as I recall, the language says specifically, this is not to be construed as a ceiling, but more a something to the effect of a basis, and that to the extent that, that there's more effort or anything, then feel free to charge more. I'm paraphrasing. But I want people who wonder, do lawyers sometimes influence legislation? You can read that statute and you can see that lawyers do. So anyway, probate can be very profitable for lawyers and personal representatives and others. Sometimes the lawyers both, depending on how the wills work.
Right, right.
Some people ask the lawyer to be the personal representative. When I use personal representative, it means the same thing as executor.
Now, what about when you choose an executor? Should you advise choosing the lawyer to serve in that role, or do you advise, you know, someone in the family?
That's a tough call. It's an important question. I can answer two questions probably in the same way. One is, how do you choose a trustee? Right? And
okay.
then how do you choose an executor or personal representative? Because it's very similar considerations. In both cases, somebody's going to have control of your stuff for a while. Now, it's true a trustee can be in place for, well, 30, 40 years, theoretically. It can be someone in place for a long time. An executor is going to be in place for a shorter period of time, but they're both powerful positions. The executor has a job under the statute to marshal the assets, meaning to assemble, identify the assets out there. So they have to identify what's out there, marshal, identify, place in safety the assets, which sometimes leaves them in control of, like the surviving widow may be in control of certain physical assets on the farm and whatnot.
Right.
You don't run and grab those and take those away from, you know, it's up to the executor to decide, can they leave the assets where they are they safe, or do I need to take them into my possession or custody? And all assets are different, whether it's physical things, whether it's money sitting somewhere, whether it's commodities. What if it's a stamp collection? Well, if there's any nervousness on the part of the family about particular stamps disappearing and not knowing, that's not unusual to have a gun collection, then particular guns suddenly appear that, hey, I remember he owned an 1899 Winchester. Where is that? And it's not to be found. So you suspect that someone got in the closet during this several months
right.
that went by after the death and before the actual probate hearing. So the executor's job – it is a responsibility, just like a trustee, is that they have to be sure the assets are safe. So they identify the assets, they secure them in some fashion, and they have them valued. So they determine the value of the estate. This is an important role. And the next step is equally important. Some would say is most important from the creditor's perspective, and that's to identify all claimants. Well, how do you know if there's people out there floating around who are owed money? And maybe they don't know that Jim Jones has died, for example, or whatnot.
But don't those creditors only have a certain amount of time after that person dies to
they
make
do.
That claim?
You're
and
right.
How long?
So you start an ad, and meaning this is something the executor does, is to give them notice. So they run an ad, and that ad will run for 6 months in a legal periodical, or the closest thing to a legal periodical in that area. And so once that notice has been done, there's a six-month period for the person to come forward. And if they don't come forward with a claim, then when the gavel goes down, the estate's closed, they're out of luck. It's because you have to have some confidence in titles and whatnot. And probate wants confidence. They don't want risk lingering out there.
Sure.
So they give a reasonable period for any creditor to come forward. But now think about all the problems that rear their head in probate. First of all, you can have people who are making claims that don't have legitimate claims. So the creditor, the executor has to be a good fiduciary. And a good fiduciary means that if there's a claim that they think's not valid, say it's a claim on the installation of a pool at the home.
Okay.
And the pool's not worked correctly. There's a crack in it. Well, how long do you think it's going to take to litigate that? So now you have probate, which is it's a legal action. Now you have a legal action within a legal action.
Right.
Because that's going on. So you have this litigation has to be settled before ultimately the estate can be settled. So that's an example, just one of many ways in which probate can be protracted into the future. So a creditor comes forward, maybe the executor doing his or her job challenges a claim. Maybe they don't. Maybe they pay it because they decide it's not worth it. And meanwhile, the four children are saying, look, we don't care about this $89 or this $8,100. You know, let's not delay this over this litigation. So executors will pay attention to the beneficiaries. Now, there's another thing that can potentially happen here during this process. Remember, the executor has identified the assets. They've secured them. They've invited creditors to come forward. Now, once they've paid all the legitimate creditors, their last step would otherwise be to distribute the money, right?
Right.
But what if somebody says, wait, I don't think that will is valid, or I think that there was another will that was lost and was made after that will? Or somebody says there was undue influence. One kid points to another kid and says, you know, he's getting more than I am because he had dad isolated and dad was under the influence of drugs during the last year of his life and he wasn't cogent.
So they can file suit against that will.
So they challenge the will. Now, sometimes there will be a no contest clause in the will. And if there's a no contest, called an interim clause. But if there's a no contest provision, then it really makes that potential heir pause because they may forfeit what they'd otherwise get.
Right.
Now, let me tell you, those provisions are no good if you're writing somebody out entirely. That's the reason a good estate planner will say to that dad who's saying, you know, this son, he's been so neglectful and of my mother and of his mother and me that I'm going to leave him nothing. Well, if that estate planning is vulnerable to the influence of the other, call it daughter, a daughter who has been with dad constantly and dad has diminished some, then a good lawyer will say, but wait now, I can tell your daughter is going to end up being challenged by this son. And a no contest clause is of no value if you're not giving the son anything. So often what will happen is in that case, then the father will say, okay, let's give him enough to where we can put in an interera, a no contest clause that will disincentivize him to challenge it.
Right, right.
So that's a strategy that's often done in estate planning.
Now, what if an executor or a trustee doesn't fulfill his or her duties and they're not distributing the inheritance money? Can't they be removed? Isn't that correct?
They can be removed.
And how does that happen, though? What does that look like?
An interested party. So incidentally, it could be a creditor who is an interested party in the legal sense of the word. But more often, it's a beneficiary who says that perhaps they have a bias or, as you said, in some other way, they're not doing their jobs. Now let me point something out. Sometimes when you're doing your estate planning, a client will say that I have complete trust in the person I'm choosing to be a personal representative or executor, and I'm not going to ask them to post a bond. But I can tell you that often what the law will require is a posting of bond, unless the testator, the person who made the will, says no bond required. Now, if it's their spouse or one of their children, they don't want them to have to post a bond in order to fulfill this role. But absent that, it's a good idea, and that's often the best remedy when you suspect there could be some bad conduct. And bad conduct doesn't necessarily mean intentional. What's more common than intentional misconduct by personal representatives is negligence. And negligence means making bad decisions, doing things incorrectly to where the estate loses a ton of money. What recourse would you have if the person doesn't have any assets to speak of? So you can always remove them, and a beneficiary can file a petition with the court for removal of a personal representative. They have to state cause. But even then, it may be of no satisfaction in terms of getting paid for any damage done. So I think that in a case where you have someone who's going to fulfill that role that you think they're a risk, it should either be an institutional trustee, which means they're backed by money and insurance.
Sure.
Institutional trustees. Well, some people say that seems cold to have a lawyers are often not good institutional trustees because they may be in a small practice and they may not have proper insurance coverage and the infrastructure to do it correctly. Banks are great institutional trustees. Trust companies, of course, are institutional trustees. But those are often not the go-to thing for people. Most people want my brother-in-law, Bill. You know, he knows he's a CPA. He'll do a good job. Well, maybe Bill is the right person. But just keep in mind that if you choose an individual that doesn't have any assets to speak of, there's not insurance coverage, and you don't require a posting of a bond, and they make a mistake, that money's gone. There's no effective recourse. Personal representatives and executors are important. And keep in mind, everything that I said just now, much of it applies in terms of the responsibilities, applies to a trustee. The compensation does not apply. There's no fixed compensation for a trustee. The statute doesn't prescribe it. However, most judges take the position that unless it's forbidden in the trust document, a judge is going to give a trustee some compensation. And they might use by analogy the schedule that Missouri has provides in a statute for personal representatives.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not specifically ordered for trustees in the state of Missouri.
Now, aren't they required by law, both trustees and executors, to provide documentation?
Yeah. They have to do an accounting. And the accounting is their last act. It's the thing that they have to do before they petition the court to close the estate. This concept, if you imagine it, that this person comes in, they file the will with the court, and they ask that the will, they offer it as a valid will, and they assert certain very fundamental things. This is a signature, there's proper attestation, et cetera. Unless that's challenged, then that will becomes the template for the ultimate distribution of assets. In the meantime, he identifies those assets, he secures them, he allows creditors to come forward. After that period of time, he pays or doesn't pay, resolves disputes, then finally distributes what's left. And then after he's distributed the money to the appropriate beneficiaries according to that will, then he prepares his accounting, and his accounting will provide detail to which beneficiaries and others can see. This is not a closed document. The public can see it.
And it's available through the courts?
Yeah, it's available through the probate court, and the public knows it. That's, incidentally, one of the big complaints about the will process. That's the reason we get to sit around and talk about Elvis Presley's estate and all these people's estates, is because it goes through probate.
It's a matter of public record, yeah. Right.
And that wonderful document, the accounting, provides just rich detail with who got what and the amount of the assets and what creditors were paid, et cetera. So it's information a lot of people – that alone is the reason some people refuse to have their assets go through a will.
Now, what does it mean that these assets should be distributed in a timely manner? I know it varies from state to state, but what does timely mean?
You know, the problem with being an executor – or a personal representative, it's not something you want to push off on anybody. And I can tell you some people regard with dread that role if they've done it before, including some lawyers who don't like to do it, even though they're paid, is that you have this rich variety of assets. It'd be different if all the assets were nice, clean bank accounts and institutions in the United States with proper security and procedures where you – that's a fairly straightforward estate. And you do have some people who that's all they have are financial accounts. But then you have others, though, who have this great variety of assets. We talked about collections, real estate in various forms, partnerships, intangible assets. Intangible assets relate to intellectual property like patents or copyrights or things like that. And they're – some assets are subject to spoilage in some way, becoming stale in some way. So those assets, what if you have cattle or other sorts of livestock And what if you have an operating business? Operating businesses are a huge headache because it's not as if you can go ahead and distribute the assets in a week and the business, you know, is just going through transition this very short period of time. I mean, the reality is, as we talked, you're talking about a year plus probably. And so this business, which is so fragile now, when you don't want it to fail, because it's probably, in most cases when you have a small business, it's the single largest asset in the estate. So we don't have to imagine big businesses. We can imagine all these businesses when you drive down a typical street in small town America. Those are all businesses, and they're very fragile. And they probably – the person who died was probably the person who was running it. So they're gone suddenly, often suddenly, like in an instant. And now the employees show up the next day. Guess who's supposed to take charge of things? Well, the executor. The executor is the one who's to preserve the assets, right? So he has the responsibility of scurrying about to figure out who's going to be in charge of this business for the next, who knows, at least 6 months, probably a year, maybe a year and a half, who knows? It's going to have to be valued. Are you going to lose these key people? What if you're an employee that shows up the next morning after the owner's passed away and you're thinking, boy, this business is going to have no future? And you may be a key employee and you're already sending your resume out by noon.
Yeah.
By noon that day, yeah, your resume's out. So these are the things that can cause an asset that at 10 minutes before that person passed away, that asset may have been worth, you know, call it $1 million. And just within weeks, if the personal representative doesn't respond appropriately, that business can be worth $100,000.
Right.
It could be worth nothing.
That makes sense.
So being a personal representative is something that does require timeliness. And they have to be prepared for any one of very different categories of assets, all of which call for a different response.
Now, what if somebody takes the executor, takes money out of it, and takes the assets from the heirs? Can they face any type of charges, criminally?
Oh, yeah. Being a fiduciary, it's literally the most solemn responsibility the law imposes on someone. So being a fiduciary, there are several examples. One is lawyers are fiduciaries. Some people might chuckle at that, but I mean, the fact is there are huge consequences if lawyers behave in anything but a selfless fashion. Now, many people are very cynical about that, but the fact is they are held to that standard. A trustee is a fiduciary. An executor is a fiduciary. An example of this fiduciary standard is many people will recall that people in the financial industry, people such as financial advisors and others were told under a new rule that was going to emanate from, I guess, the SEC, that they were going to be regarded as fiduciaries. And that was a big, big deal to them. And many felt that it would have a dramatic impact potentially on their income. And the reason that their industry fought that so vigorously was being a fiduciary means that all your advice has to be selfless. And it has to be without regard to your commission, other things. And the reality is that's not the way that the world in sales works. It's enough for you just to be honest, but a fiduciary standard is above that. So anyway, that's the what people are held to if they act in the role of executor or trustee. So if someone behaves that way, yeah, there are all sorts of causes of action. There's liability in court. There's potentially criminal charges.
What would those charges be?
Well, fraud, misappropriation.
Fraud. Okay.
Yeah. There are all sorts of incentives to behave correctly if you occupy the role of a fiduciary.
Now, if someone, like you said, wanted to have someone removed, they could petition the courts. Does that mean they would have to act through a lawyer, or they could just go to the courthouse and fill out this paperwork? And
realistically, they would want to have a lawyer because it means filing the petition with the court. It's not a simple thing to do. It's always technically possible for someone to appear pro se, meaning without a lawyer.
Right.
But as a practical matter, they're going to need a lawyer. I mean, that's the nature of probate. And probate entails all these issues we've talked about, and it provides grist for all these different players in the process and the court system, the lawyers, the appraisers, the lawyers representing claimants, not to mention beneficiaries. So it really is it's a process that you don't want to voluntarily use. And when you have an alternative, as people do, they have trusts. And trusts provide a wonderful place to deposit your assets, to have a more control of them while you're alive. While you're alive, a trust is can be very helpful. It's not just something that benefits you when you're gone, as a will does. But a trust is instead something that, to the extent that you can no longer be your own trustee, then you name somebody who would succeed you. So you anticipate the possibility that you're going to become incompetent at some point.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and we've talked about that many times on the show.
Yes, and it's a smooth transition. You don't need courts. You don't need judges. You don't have a competency hearing. It happens automatically. And it's a little different than a durable power of attorney, though you'd want both. But the durable power of attorney is kind of like a blank check, meaning – and I don't mean that in a negative way, but it is. It's this incredibly powerful piece of paper that allows you to access everything. And some people say, well, that's exactly what I'd want. And for some people who hold that piece of paper, that's what they should have. But for others, there should be more structure. And a trust imposes that structure. So rather than they're having this piece of paper in their hand that allows them to do and move and sell and buy and do anything in your life, in your assets that they choose, instead they succeed to a position with a set of rules. And those rules you've defined in this trust. It's very different from a durable power of attorney that stands on its own. Now, we often we recommend that you have both. You want a durable power of attorney for anything that you didn't put in your trust. So it is a good idea because there's stuff floating out there that you may decide that you're not going to put in your trust for various reasons. And that may not be a bad idea. Lower valued assets, some things like that. But all your important assets like your house, your financial accounts, et cetera.
Savings accounts, CDs, anything like that.
Those would typically go in the trust, and those would be subject to the authority of the trustee. So you're trustee until you can't be, and then you have a mechanism that automatically, without a judge, without a court, without a lawyer, has this other person immediately take the reins, and it can occur in an instant. So it's very efficient to have trust. And then, of course, the reason that most people are familiar with is when you do ultimately pass away, guess what? You could pass away at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday, your assets could be distributed the next morning.
Wow.
Now, I'd like to think my relatives were mourning and not counting their share. But just to make a point, yes. I mean, that's how – contrast what I just described with what we talked about earlier with probate.
Right. That's a year, as you said.
Yeah. I mean, what a potential mess. And even the best case scenario, even where you don't have a mess – you have expense and you have delay.
But what are the pros for doing a will? What would, you know, be a reason someone would choose doing a will as opposed to a trust? In your opinion.
The only reason I can think of would be that they may save money on the cost of a will. I mean, they can order a will and spend a few hundred bucks on it, and they may feel that they've saved money versus if they had spent – most trusts, you're going to spend north of $1,000, in some cases two or three, if you have significant assets. But I'm just really impatient with that, and not just because I'm a lawyer, in fairness. When I didn't practice in this area, when I was doing just divorce law, I mean my position to family members and people I cared about was why would you choose to squeeze nickels at a time when what's at stake is everything you've accumulated in this
right.
world. And normally that means, for the people I was talking to, it probably meant something north of $500,000. These are not rich people, but they have, you know, north of $500,000. And you're going to make a decision about the disposition of your estate, everything you've accumulated in this world, based on the difference between $200 and $2,000. It just seems very short-sighted. I mean, that's not the time to make that difference when there's so much on the table. And furthermore, what they've done is they pass the expense to others. Oh, it's not as if – it'd be bad enough if they argued just based on the 200 versus the, say, 2,000. I would argue that is a very short-sighted decision given the convenience and all of the trust. But it doesn't stop there. They end up having spent probably 5 to 10 times maybe what they would have paid for that trust.
Well, now, the individual who creates the trust, when they are adding trust throughout their lifetime, I imagine they have to spend, you know, more legal fees to have that trust added. Am I correct?
Yeah, but, well, no, it depends. Now, if you have a big change in your life that you didn't anticipate, then you might go back and have your trust changed. So that's a fair point. But for most people doing their planning, say, they're 55 years old. Now they should be doing it, they're 25. But realistically, most people doing their planning when they're 55 years old. They're probably not ever going to change that trust. In all likelihood, the changes that were anticipated are there. They anticipated the death of a spouse. They anticipated their children being in a certain position.
Right.
So for the most part, there will be no changes to that trust ever. That's it. Now, if they do decide to move stuff in and out, they don't need a lawyer for that. They can do that themselves. The whole idea of a trust is for it to be self-managing. You don't have to go back to lawyers and spend more money.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One thing I should mention real quick, we're about out of time, is, and I don't want to fail to at least include this. Again, as I mentioned earlier, it is true that you can have a sort of poor man's will where you change titles to different documents in ways that they don't go through probate, meaning that it is true that if you add a name to an account under a payable on death
right,
provision
P-O-D.
In a bank account, it's true that money will not go through probate. And the same thing is true for a beneficiary deed with real estate.
With a home.
So I don't want to fail to mention that. I'm critical of that because it's not a plan, but at least people want to know that is an alternative to a will. It has a ton of limits. We don't have time to talk about it, but we've covered a lot of territory.
We sure have. I feel much more knowledgeable.
Well, I've talked a little quickly because I did want to cover these fundamentals. Time has flown. So until we get together next time, this has been another episode of Elder Talk. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.